taking a look at your pet's health here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Larry Mueller here with my guest, Dr. Sandy Sawchuk of the University of Wisconsin School of Veterinary Medicine. Great to have her back. She comes by about once a month to talk with us about pet health issues. And certainly if you would like to join in with your own question or comment, I hope you do that. You can reach us at 1-800-642-1234 or email us at talk@wpr.org. Dr. Sandy, welcome back. Good to have you with us.
It's nice to be back.
You and I were talking before the show, and you mentioned an issue relating to salmonella I thought worth talking about.
Yeah, you know, now that we are getting inklings that spring is on the way, you know, snow's starting to melt, and I was out picking up dog droppings this weekend, you know, as the snow started to melt away. But around bird feeders, a concern that we always have is that, you know, come winter, you know, you're feeding the birds, and if you look under my bird feeder, there's a big pile of, like, spent seed and things, and probably a lot of bird droppings as well. And if you've got cats or dogs that are outside and hanging around in that area, and I know that my dogs love to eat rabbit droppings and they tend to be down in that area as well, there's always a risk of that. So, you know, as soon as you can, get out there and clean up all that seed to make it safer for your pets.
That makes very good sense. Recalls? Any recalls on food?
There always is recalls, you know, and it's just that because, you know, pet food manufacturers are, you know, always being very careful about watching. And the latest one that I read about was with the Wellness brand, which is one of the more popular foods that I'm seeing a lot of people feeding to their cats now. And this is specifically their canned cat food. And it wasn't a problem that the food was toxic, it was deficient in a vitamin called thiamine or vitamin B1. And that can be quite serious for cats. And this just goes to show you that my motto that I live by when it comes to pet food is variety is the spice of life. You know, it's okay to, you know, switch off every now and then. And, you know, you want to do changes slowly, but, you know, don't just get your pet fixated on one brand or one flavor of food, because then you could be stuck if something like this happens. Obviously, this is a reputable company. They're doing their best to get this thing fixed right now.
Okay. And chew toys.
Yeah, you know, and it's just kind of it could potentially be a big topic, but I get so many owners coming in and asking me, what's the best toy to give my dog? And every dog is different depending on what they like. But the things that I can say is avoid toys that are inflexible and hard. So that would go with Nylabones. Regular bones. They break teeth. They can cause problems with being foreign bodies if chunks are swallowed. Any toy you get your dog, you need to know their chewing capability and not leave them alone with it until you know that it's going to be safe. There was even back a couple of years ago reports of some pretty benign looking dog balls that had a single hole in it that would entrap the tongue or cheek tissue or whatever, because it would be like the, you know, the Chinese finger torture thing where you can't get it out. And so you always have to be careful and be observant when you're leaving toys with your dogs.
Let's go to Willem in Colfax has a question for you. Hi, Willem. Thanks for calling.
Hi. I have a cat that has this sort of like skin, these little bumps on his skin. And I read somewhere that it might be caused by fleas, some sort of allergic reaction to fleas. But we have two other cats, and none of them have this problem. And I've never seen any signs of fleas, any flea dirt. And I am familiar with cats that have had fleas before. He's had like a cortisone injection, and he's had two courses of antibiotics, and it's still, they're like little scabby bumps.
What you're describing is something that is given the name miliary dermatitis.
Right, that's what I...
Yeah, and it's usually, you're correct, usually due to some type of an allergy. And by far, fleas and flea allergy dermatitis are very common. So if but you may have one cat and that is extremely sensitive to fleas and the other cats aren't. But, you know, being on the lookout for using a flea comb for flea droppings, adult fleas, if your cats are strictly mostly indoors. They're not going outside. They're not hunting. Fleas are probably pretty low risk, but I know if you came in to see our dermatologist, they would probably put your cat on some type of long-acting flea prevention. And there's, you know, like something like Frontline or Advantage. There's a new one out right now that just came out for cats, and I'm going through my notes here trying to see if I can find it. There it is. Okay. Because it just literally is hitting the market. It's called Assurity, and it's a spot-on product for cats, only for cats, not for dogs, and it only gets fleas, doesn't get ticks. But that might be something to talk to your veterinarian about as well. But there are other things cats can become allergic to. Sometimes we'll see environmental allergens to things like house dust mites and pollens and molds, which are in everyone's home. And sometimes it's even food allergies where they're allergic to an ingredient in the food, a protein source. So if you want to get to the bottom of this, I think you need to be looking at, you know, trying to address, you know, why is my cat, you know, getting these bumps, and be willing to maybe change your cat's diet to a hypoallergenic diet, which means separating the cats out during feeding, using some flea control. Very unlikely that this is a bacterial infection, so I'd probably nix the antibiotics unless your vet has actually proven that there's a bacterial problem there.
Okay.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah, thanks a lot for calling, Willem. Lois in La Crosse, on to you. Hi, Lois.
Good morning.
Morning.
I'm calling on behalf of a daughter and family who got a beautiful chocolate lab in December, and they're very conscientious pet owners. They live in Los Angeles, and when taking it in for routine shots or care, they've been dismayed to find extra things, bacterial or viral things, which have required treatment, and this seems to have become quite frequent. My daughter said several people told her you have to be careful because in that area some vets will actually almost gratuitously add on extra conditions or treatments. In an area like that, how does one find the best vet?
Oh, you know, and in any profession, there's always going to be a bad apple. And I really feel sorry for your daughter. If the veterinarian is pulling this kind of stuff, it shouldn't happen. And if they have evidence that, you know, something, there's treatments being done that are inappropriate, I would definitely talk to the licensing board, because, I mean, that's absolutely wrong. But just the fact that you said chocolate lab, and when it goes in, I mean, almost every lab that I see usually has an ear infection, or a lot of them have skin infections, interdigital dermatitis. They have, you know, there's a lot of issues that just labs in general tend to have. And so when they're going in for, as you called it, a vaccine appointment, it really is not just the vaccines that are the important thing. It's the fact that the veterinarian is doing a thorough physical and perhaps pointing out things to your daughter that are in need of attention for the dog. So I'm going to go on the side that this veterinarian is on the up and up, knows what they're doing, and, you know, and maybe your daughter is just not paying close enough attention to the dog to find, you know, some of these things ahead of time and maybe get them addressed rather than waiting until the vaccination appointment. If she just wants vaccines and does not want a physical done, there are various places that do just vaccination clinics. They're kind of, I call them drive-by shooting appointments, you know, where they just come in and out. But remember, the most important thing when you're going in for those vaccines to a veterinarian is getting that physical done. Annual, if not twice a year, is really helpful and recommended. But how do you find a veterinarian? There's a few things you may want to be looking into. One is just good recommendations from friends and family that have pets that you know that are well cared for. That would be number one. Number two, it would be to look for a hospital that is an animal hospital, American Animal Hospital Association approved hospital. It has a little logo called AHA, A-A-H-A. And all that is just telling you that the hospital is equipped with the equipment that they need, that they're doing everything by the book. There's good ventilation. The kennel system's fine. The food is stored correctly. I mean, and that the veterinarians are getting, you know, have enough educational material and so on there. So they check on the library that you have in your clinic. So there's lots of things, but it still is not addressing the veterinarian. Although it's a very good organization for continuing education, they don't follow up with that. But, yeah, you know, and I think you could also also check with the licensing board and be, you know, this is public information. If there's a veterinarian whose license has been in jeopardy, that would be something that you could check out as well, or have your daughter check out. Mm-hmm. But hopefully that's not the case.
That's very helpful. Okay. Thank you.
All right. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. An email from Chris in Fredonia. They have a 9-year-old, 60-pound-plus dog who has diagnosed ACL injury. He's a large breed, not overweight. We've tried ASA, which seems to control his pain fairly well, but eventually he began vomiting, so the vet recommended Rimadyl. After a 2-week trial and walking him only short distances on a leash, he's no better. The vet suggested PT. Wondering how to go about finding a qualified animal therapist in our area of northern Ozaukee County. Also, are there therapies for ACL injuries short of surgery? He's an elderly dog for at least his primary breed, which is a Bernese Mountain Dog. We just don't know. We should allow him freedom in his final years, thereby risking further injury or invalid him, which makes him miserable.
Oh, you know, and this is a really, a number of things came up in this little email. Anterior cruciate ligament injury is a surgical condition. You will find, if you go searching online, there's a company that you can have your veterinarian make a mold of the dog's leg. It would require shaving and maybe some sedation, but they will make a specific brace for the dog. They don't work very well. I've had one client that's used it, and it did give the dog some added support, but, you know, eventually they end up with arthritis and, you know, serious complications with their ability to be able to get around. So remember, age isn't a disease, and if your dog is healthy for anesthesia, it may be something you'd want to consider having done. But when it comes to medical management for pain, yes, I think that while you're waiting to make that decision, where do we go, your dog needs to be on pain medication. I don't like to see aspirin being used in dogs. As this writer found out, it causes gastrointestinal upset in dogs, and many dogs will vomit and get ulcers. There are other safer prescription products made for dogs that we know are much safer, such as Rimadyl that was mentioned. So, you know, avoid just over-the-counter using your own medications if you can. When it comes to physical therapy, I don't know anyone up in your area, but your veterinarian would be the first one to be able to give you an idea, since they probably have sent other patients to a physical therapist. There's, you know, veterinary technicians and human physical therapists are now segueing over into the animal line, and they're readily available. In the Madison area, we have several people that do physical therapy. Yeah. But again, that may just help support the muscle tissue there. The damage to the joint is already done, but it may help your dog with at least, you know, not losing total function of the leg.
There we go. Keith in Wisconsin Dells, on to you now. Hi, Keith.
Hello. How you doing today, Larry?
Great. Thanks for calling. What's on your mind?
Thanks for having me. Oh, well, doctor, I have a couple questions, but my first question is we picked up a cat probably about a year ago from the Sauk County Humane Society, and it's a great cat. It's a big boy. He's about 16 pounds, and he's got an attitude, and when you pet him for too long, he attacks you, but he wants to be pet. It's not like we're doing something he doesn't want. And also, if he wants something in the house, like if he wants to be fed some soft food and we don't feed him right away, he'll attack us.
Oh, my goodness. Yeah. What you're describing is what I like to call the controlling cat. And just like in the dog population, you can see a whole wide range of personalities. The easy, middle-of-the-road cat, the very, very fearful and skittish cat, and then the cat that is in total control of everything. These cats tend to be, just as you've described them, very demanding, saying, feed me now, or I'll bite you. They may lay in the middle of the living room floor or in a hallway and say, I'm not getting up. You have to step around me. And maybe if you get too close, they'll swat at you as you go past. They come up and they sit on your lap and demand to be petted, but they don't have a really good way of saying, I've had enough, except to bite you. And so those are very, very typical things that we'll see in the controlling cat. And I would few things that you may want to consider doing. Number one would be train your cat. People don't think about training their cats, but just like we would for a dog that's very controlling and demanding, we would say, make them sit before they get their dinner. Make them do something so it becomes a job. They have to say please first by sitting, then, you know, you give them their food. And so you can teach a cat to sit, but, you know, ask him to do something prior to feeding. So you're putting meals, you're back in charge rather than him saying, feed me now, stupid. When he jumps up in your lap, all I would recommend is maybe a scratch or two, just a little pet, 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 you know, in the area that he likes to be petted in. And right. If you can't move him off your lap without having him react and being aggressive, then I would just stand up and let gravity do its thing. So that, again, you're in control of how long the petting session lasts. And eventually that may be able to go a little bit longer. But again, you're just putting everything back in your hands as being the one that's in control. And I would carry something like a squirt gun or a can of compressed air. If he's doing the passive aggression, like laying in the hallway, go ahead, make my day type thing, make him move so that you are now in control of the hallway and not putting yourself at risk of being bit by using your hands or your feet to make him move. So hopefully that'll train him that, you know, I can get the things I want in life, but I just have to back off on how pushy I am.
Mm-hmm.
You definitely hit it right on the head, because he does think he's a dog. I mean, he's the only cat that I've ever seen that growls when he eats, or will even growl at you if you come by him when he eats.
Wow.
So definitely explain him to a T.
Yeah.
Okay, that's great, Doc. And then my second question is for fleas. When you got a bad case of fleas in the house, the vet talked to me about something I believe is called Cipirol, or I think it's called something on that order. And I guess my question is I want to know the down effects. I have kids. I have other pets. Yeah. And I'll just take that answer off the air.
Okay, good question. There are so many good topical medications now for fleas that are safely used in cats. Besides this one that I just mentioned called Assurity, Frontline is now available in, it's now, I believe there's even a couple of like generic type brands that are out there, and I can't remember what they're called right now, but I think they're just starting to be able to hit the market. But Frontline's very safe, and the other one is called Advantage, which is, again, very safe products to use in cats, and they last for a month. So the big thing is treat every animal in the household that is, you know, can get fleas. I wouldn't put it on your birds or, you know, anything like that, or your fish or whatever, but dogs, cats, everybody needs to be treated. Vacuum everything, hardwood floors, around baseboards and so on, to be able to suck up flea eggs, some of the larvae, and the fecal pellets that may be there. I typically don't have to, at this point, even use any household treatments if you just treat the pet effectively. And I'd be looking at least a minimum of 3 months for strictly indoor pets. If they're indoor-outdoor, have them on flea control year-round.
Dr. Sandy Sawchuk, our guest, clinical professor at the University of Wisconsin-Madison School of Veterinary Medicine. I'm Larry Mueller. Judith Sears-Poisson, our on-air producer here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We'll take some more of your calls and emails. Let's go back to the phones. Joyce in Foxborough, Wisconsin, you're next. Hi, Joyce.
Hi, Larry. Hi, Dr. Sandy.
Hi.
First off, I do have a feral cat who's been living at my house for about 5 years. And it's a mobile home in the country, and we would like to keep her on the property and not boot her out. But my problem is last year she did have 3 kitties that we got under the house, and I have a cat in my house who's 2 years old, and he's like the last caller's cat, a controlling cat, and 2 dogs. The situation is she crawls under my house in between a basement and the mobile home wall where my heater vents are.
Mm-hmm.
So all day and all night I have the animals stirring around the vents, smelling, making noises, sometimes barking. Right. And then, of course, she's a very invisible cat, low maintenance. We've never fed her until this year because it got so cold. And I thought, well, geez, what am I starting, you know, by feeding her a little bit during the freezing weather? But she's been here 5 years. So.
Okay. Yeah, so she is basically your cat that's an outdoor cat.
Yes.
And what I would recommend is talking to your animal control officer. And even like in our Madison area here, we have a group called Friends of Ferals, which your locality may have as well. It's a group that you can, you know, talk to them, get good information on how to trap these cats. If she can't be caught and she can't touch her, then obviously live trapping her, getting her in to be spayed or neutered. When they do that, they would likely tip her ear as well, which means that they take a little tip off the top of her ear so mm-hmm. that she can be recognized from a distance that she's a spayed female cat. That's going to help control the population. Many of these, spay-neutered things are done with just, you know, either a donation or a very small fee to cover some of the expenses. And so check with, you know, your veterinarian, your local animal control officer, and just say, this is what we've got going on. To be able to get her out from under your house, I think you're looking at probably calling, rather than a veterinarian, a carpenter or somebody that can help you with reinforcing your house to be able to keep her out of there. But because she's now in that area and this is her hunting ground,
we would actually welcome her to stay if we could move her down to like a little shed barn that
right. And that's what you'd need to do, is be able to provide her with a structure that will keep her warm in the winter, allow her some shelter so that she can be away from predators and so on.
Right.
If you do that, she may just stay around.
I do believe she will. And like I said, she's totally welcome because she's been a great mouser. I haven't had any problems whatsoever.
Mm-hmm.
But we would like to relocate her down to this barn. Are there any tricks to doing that?
Well,
and if she does have another litter, is it safe to just pick the babies up and move them to the barn? Do you think that she would migrate down there to the babies?
She might, or she may just abandon them, or she may pick them up and move them back to her favorite spot again. So
right.
I think that that's why you need to be looking at how can I, you know, block this. But
yeah.
I think if you do trap her, then confine her in the area where you want her to be, so that that now becomes a spot that she finds comfortable.
She's
you can feed, you know, provide her with food there. Yeah, it's going to be a tough one, but that's the problem with outdoor cats like this. They lead their own life, and you can only do so much for them. But I think the best thing you can do is remove those ovaries and uterus to stop that overpopulation.
Yeah, there you go. Good luck. Thank you, Joyce, for calling. Appreciate your call. We have an email from Valerie in Burnham Wood. Throughout his life, once in a while during the night while he's sleeping, our dog will howl. During the more than 8.5 years we've had Bo, he has only howled one time while being awake. And this occurred after we bought him, and he saw some coyotes heard some coyotes howling, and he howled back. But when he howls in his sleep, we usually wake up and give him a big hug in case he's howling for sad reasons.
No.
It would be interesting to know what dogs dream about and where they learn to make these sounds when they have not really been around them.
Yeah, well, you know, some dogs are just born howlers. My bulldogs don't howl, but, you know, most of the northern breeds and, you know, the baying of the beagle, every breed kind of has their own little kind of a unique kind of vocalization. I can be back in, you know, the far back end of the clinic and hear a beagle come into the front office, and I go, oh, there's a beagle up there. And I now have got to the point where I can recognize bulldog vocalizations and so on. But, I'd love to know what they're dreaming. It's kind of fun. My guess is that he's just, you know, maybe, you know, dreaming of running with the coyotes and the wolves. So, you know, just enjoy it. I don't know if I'd wake him up unless he feels distressed, you know. So don't worry about probably waking him.
Do you have an answer for cats who chew electrical cords?
Ooh, yeah. I mean, either...
That's not a good thing.
It's not a good thing. You may be looking at having your cat have pretty serious burns or even death from electrocution. Keep cords wrapped up. Keep them, some people will put them, run them through some conduit, or there's things that can attach to the wall that will hold cords and so on. I know I have that with my cable for my cable for the television. I've had some people paint something on the cord that tastes bad, like bitter apple or Tabasco or, you know, something really nasty tasting so that the cat doesn't want to chew on it. But it also comes down to redirecting the cat to something that would be appropriate to chew on. And so if you've got a cat that really likes to have that kind of, you know, rubbery type stuff in their mouth, start looking in the small dog toy aisle, and you may be able to find, you know, pretty indestructible toys. But again, you want to watch your cat when you mm-hmm. give them a new toy that they can chew on. I've even had some cats that like the little rawhide sticks that look like pencils, the real yeah. thin ones. They'll pick those up and carry them around and chew on them just like a dog would. So again, just rather than saying, no, I don't want you chewing on this, what's the yes? Okay, what can I transfer my chewing over to? So I think you probably have to do both things, you know, try mm-hmm. to keep the cords from being handy and make them taste bad, but also redirect.
What's your opinion of the, this is from Isabel email, what's your opinion of the Lyme disease vaccine for dogs? We spend a lot of time up north in the summer. I worry about ticks.
Yeah, there are several Lyme vaccines on the market right now. They basically all do the same thing. The one that we are currently using in the clinic is what's called an outer surface protein A/C vaccine. I'm not going to get into immunology, but there's you know, there's some thoughts that maybe potentially that one may be a little bit better than some of the other ones, but they pretty well all work the same way. Lyme vaccine, I think, is important for dogs that, if you're practicing good tick control and you're still finding ticks on your dog, it is something that you should talk to your veterinarian about using. They appear to be very safe. They do need to be given annually, but, you know, it's not a substitute for flea and tick control, so you still need to use something. We are seeing, at least in our area, about equal numbers of pets with another tick-borne disease called anaplasma, which is also spread by the same tick that spreads the Lyme organism. So, if you're going up north a lot and you're seeing ticks, even if you're using good tick control, feel free to, you know, talk to your veterinarian about that. I think it would be a safe thing to do.
Doug in Caledonia, we're on to you now. Hi, Doug.
Hey, hello, doctor. How you doing?
Fine, thank you.
See, I have two Newfoundlands. One's a purebred. He's 7 years old. The other, he's half St. Bernard. He's 4 years old. Now, when he turned two, he started having seizures, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And we took him to the vet, and he diagnosed him with epilepsy. So we have him on phenobarbital
mm-hmm.
that we give him twice a day with his meals. But the funny thing is, it only happens in the summertime. In the wintertime, he does not have a seizure. And I thought, what is going on? I mean, is he out there in the yard licking toads or eating mushrooms, you know?
Yeah.
Because I live out in the country, and I finally figured it out. You know, every dog I've had, they like eating that tall grass that mm-hmm. dips off of it, and mm-hmm. then they regurgitate, it settles their stomach.
Yeah.
Well, every time he does that, it scrambles his brain. And
oh, my goodness.
And he has a seizure.
Huh. Well, that's would be a strange coincidence, but it may just be a coincidence. You know, many dogs that are epileptics will start having seizures right about the age that your dog did, around 2 years of age. And there are, you know, whenever we have a dog that's had a seizure, the things that we always want to do is rule out problems that could be outside of the brain that could be causing seizures, such as toxins, liver abnormalities, blood sugar abnormalities, that type of thing. And then, you know, start looking at, is there something in the brain? Like, do you have a congenital brain defect like hydrocephalus? Do you have an older dog, something like a brain tumor? Do you have an infection in your brain? And so depending on what your veterinarian finds on physical exam, the age that it starts, and so on, there's kind of a standard protocol we go through. But a two-year-old dog that's healthy in all other regards, lab works normal, I would be putting things like brain tumors way down low on the list, especially if the seizures are coming infrequently and can be controlled with phenobarb. Mm-hmm. Why your dog is having seizures more in the summer may just be a simple thing of activity. We know that when dogs are, you know, have a lot of stress in their life, they're, you know, like around Christmas time, or maybe it's over the weekend when grandma came to visit, that night is usually the time that the dog seizures. So maybe in the summer, if your dog's spending more time outside and gets into a really deep state of sleep at night because they're so well exercised, that may be what's triggering the seizure. I doubt that it would be a toxin. If not, I would think that both your dogs would be having seizures as well. So I think stay with the phenobarb. I wouldn't be looking at anything unless you are actively applying pesticides, which then keep your pet away from that area that you've treated.
Mm-hmm.
Why do dogs eat grass anyway?
Oh, well, my flippant answer to that is some dogs just like a salad now and then. And, you know, many dogs just like the taste of grass and they will go ahead and eat it. Others will eat it, as you've said, as a purgative. If their stomach's upset, they may go out and eat grass selectively to make themselves vomit. But many dogs start eating grass when they're feeling good and it's like, whoops, that's irritating my tummy. Now they vomit it up. And it's just the action of the grass caused the vomiting. They weren't feeling sick before. So, they, you know, who knows? But it's just one of those things that many dogs do, and it is usually very safe unless they're ingesting tons of it. I have had a couple of grass impactions in dogs.
Oh, there you go, Doug. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate it. And I want to give Nora and Madison a chance to join us. Nora, hi.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I have a cat. She's 16 years old. And she was recently diagnosed with hyperthyroidism.
Mm-hmm.
And I was told her level was at a 12.
Ooh, that's up there. Yep.
Yeah. And also the blood work showed she had elevated liver enzymes and a heart murmur.
Okay.
So they started her on one pill a day. I can't remember what it is, but it's a common medicine they use for hyperthyroidism.
It's called methimazole.
Okay. Yeah. Yep. And I was wondering kind of what kind of treatment options, other options there are, should be talking about with my vet. She's going in another 2 weeks to be checked again if there are things I should be doing at home.
Yeah.
I don't know much about this.
Okay. It's a very common disease in aged cats, and it's a problem where they develop benign nodules in their thyroid gland that secrete thyroid hormone. And what the thyroid gland is made to do is control metabolism. And so when you've got a overactive thyroid gland, their metabolism is basically put into overdrive. So they're hungry all the time. They tend to lose weight. It really puts a, because their heart rate's up, because of their metabolism being up, it puts a lot of strain in the heart, and you can get heart murmurs. You may see elevated liver enzymes. Typically, unless she has some pre-existing heart disease or liver problems, we'll see on recheck, these cats, their liver problems will be back to normal. Their heart murmur may just totally disappear. And, you know, they go back to being a relatively normal cat. The one thing that we really need to carefully monitor, especially in older cats with hyperthyroidism, is kidney function. They can go into being treated with hyperthyroidism with what looks like normal kidney function.
Yeah.
But once we slow that heart rate down, lower their blood pressure, it can unmask the severity of their pre-existing kidney disease. So we always want to be really careful in the initial treatment with careful monitoring. It sounds like your vet is right on the ball and doing everything right by the book with getting you back in again a couple weeks later. And they're starting out with treatment slowly. Many cats need to be treated twice a day. I'll often do this, start once a day, see how they do. If it doesn't, you know, control their thyroid level or symptoms, we'll bump it up a little bit with, again, carefully monitoring all their body functions. If she tolerates being in a normal thyroid state with this medication and doesn't have any secondary complications with her bone marrow or kidneys or anything, there's two ways you can go. One would be to stay on the medication that you're currently on for the rest of her life with monitoring probably every 6 months or so. The other would be to consider radioactive iodine treatment. That obviously has to be done at only select places because it takes some pretty heavy duty licensing to be working with radioactive material, and they have to have special containment facilities and so on for the cat. But it's just an injection of radioactive material that's picked up by the active thyroid gland and basically fries the nodule so that they then go back to being a normal thyroid cat. So might be something to consider talking to your veterinarian about once you get your cat under control with the oral medication.
All right.
Okay.
Thanks.
Great. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks, Nora, for calling. And Lucy in Appleton, we move to you now. Hi, Lucy.
Hi. I have a cat, and he is a year past his vaccination. But my problem is getting him to the vet because he goes to the bathroom in his carrier.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And so I was asking some friends, like, what I should do, and they were telling me that maybe I should give him a little bit of Benadryl before I take him to kind of maybe knock him out. But I don't really want to do that.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, this is a big thing that even in the veterinary world we're looking at is, you know, why do so few cats actually make it into the vet? And one of the biggest things that people will say is the resistance of the cat to get in the carrier and come to the vet clinic. So a few things that you would want to consider doing. Number one would be making sure that you are using a carrier that's easy to get the cat in and out of, and make sure that you introduce the carrier at a time when you are not taking him to the clinic. So you maybe have it dismantled and it's just the lower half of the clamshell, throw some food in, you know, make it fun for him to go in there, eventually start putting it all back together. And now this carrier that has never been a problem for him before because you haven't used it to go to the clinic, is now this fun place to go in.
We tried doing that when we were moving. Before we moved for a month, we got the carrier out to get used to it. But instead of, like, going by the area where the carrier was, he just ignored it.
Okay, yeah.
Like, so he avoided that spot of the room.
Yeah. And that's why you have to use things like bribery, like putting bits of tuna or turkey lunch meat or something like that in it. You can talk to a veterinarian, and they may be able to prescribe an antiemetic for you to be able to use.
And they told me that I'd have to take him in.
That's the problem. If you have not maintained a patient-doctor relationship, giving prescription medications could be a problem. But there are some over-the-counter antiemetics that are going to work better than the Benadryl that you were going to be using. So, talking to the veterinarian about using something like Dramamine or whatever, again, many cats override that, but it may be worth a try. Another thing to consider is a vet that makes house calls, and see if that doesn't make a difference for your cat, is just having the physical exam and vaccines done as a house call, rather than considering, you know, trucking your cat into the clinic.
Yeah.
Awesome. I never thought about the house call.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Okay.
Well, there are vets out there who do that.
There are.
Lots of them. Beth in Sheboygan, your turn. Hi, Beth.
Hi, how are you?
Good. Thanks for calling.
Yes, I have two male Yorkies, Reggie and Murphy, and they're just over a year, maybe a year and a half now. And I've tried just about everything in regards to them not marking in the house. I've crated them. I've taken them out every hour. Just about everything. They are not neutered, and I have issues with neutering, but I just don't know what to do.
Why do you have issues with neutering?
Well, I feel, you know, it's like, you know, doing something to them that, you know, not necessarily they need to have done.
Well, in this case, it needs to get done. That's probably why they're lifting their leg. They're intact male dogs that are marking their territory. And now you've got two age-matched, breed-matched, sex-matched dogs living, and they're in competition with each other. And so it's very, very common to even see a single male dog that's intact to leg lift. But you put two together, whoa, you've like more than doubled the incidence of it. So really consider getting them neutered. Besides helping with that behavior problem, it will prevent, obviously, testicular cancer. Guaranteed that if you don't neuter them, they are going to have prostate problems as they get older. And and so that will help prevent benign prostatic hyperplasia and some of the other kind of testosterone-related things like perianal tumors and perineal hernias and so on. So I think you're doing your dogs a disservice by letting them stay in this testosterone-charged environment when they're not being used for breeding and or showing. So, you know...
They don't show any aggression or anything toward each other. They're really good. In fact, I think they're in love with each other.
Yeah, and you know, and that's great that you can have them getting along, because many households with two intact male dogs together are going to see a lot of fighting. But this just may be their competition, you know, and it's, so a few things you may want to try after you've neutered them is make sure you're using a good odor eliminator. And I like things like Urine Off is one of my favorites. There's another one called Anti-Icky Poo AIP that I like. You have to probably go around your house at night with a black light to be able to see where the urine is so you can treat all of the spots. I would make sure that you plug in a DAP diffuser, a dog appeasement pheromone diffuser, strategically in your house so you can get those at pet stores. Helps kind of make the environment a little less stressful for the dogs. And then, you know, keeping close eye on them. And sometimes we have to have the dog on a leash and only have one out at a time so that we can, you know, keep a close eye on them. dogs. There are some dogs that even after neutering will still continue to lift their leg because of the social interaction with the other dogs. So, you know, we'll get rid of the sex part. You can, you know, work on the odor part, but there may still be that competition between the two of them even after being fixed.
There you go. Good luck. Thank you, Beth, for calling. Appreciate your call. And we have an email from Kelsey in Oconomowoc. We'll get to that in just a minute. Dr. Sandy Sawchuk, our guest, here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Talking your pet's health today with Dr. Sandy Sawchuk, clinical professor in the University of Wisconsin School of Veterinary Medicine. I want to go to Kelsey in Oconomowoc, but before that, we just had a listener wonder about the new cat flea treatment that you mentioned, Sandy.
Yeah.
I wanted to get that name.
Yeah, it's called Assurity, and it's made by a company named Elanco. It is a spot-on treatment that is a single agent, and I'm probably going to blow the name how to say it, but it's like spine, like the back of your spine, and then torum, spine torum is the name of the chemical. It appears to be very, very safe for cats. Will kill up to, starts within 12 hours, about 100% of the fleas are dead on the cat.
Oh, man.
So works very, very well. And it lasts for a full month. So, something to think about using.
Absolutely.
And, you know, very effective. So
now Kelsey in Oconomowoc has a 1-year-old Bichon with allergies to something that causes him to scratch himself so much he opens wounds. He's been on antibiotics to allow these scabs to heal on several occasions, takes one prednisone a day. She recently tried to take one capsule every other day, but they had to give that up right away because he's so itchy. And nothing seems to help here. He's still miserable. He's on a strict diet, that's sweet potato and venison. I don't give him any other protein source when I give him the pills either. No peanut butter or anything like that.
Oh, good, good.
The diet doesn't seem to be helping either. It's been 3 weeks. It wasn't the grass outdoor irritant because he still had itchiness all winter.
Oh, you know, she brought up a number of things here. First of all, when dogs are allergic, it can be year-round. And they are trying something with the diet. She said it's only been 3 weeks. I would not expect much of a change within 3 weeks. It can take 6 to 8 weeks or even longer for a dietary modification to be able to show the dog some benefit from that. Definitely you need to be working on something. Keeping your dog on prednisone on a daily basis is going to cause long-standing adrenal problems, liver problems. It's going to actually predispose them to infections and so on. So we really need to get them off of the prednisone. Not sure if your dog has been allergy tested, but that would be something that you can talk to your veterinarian about. There is a blood test that can be done, and as well as skin testing for allergies too. The drug that I would usually put dogs on that we're just trying to control the symptoms of allergies is a drug for long-term use, is a drug called cyclosporin, and it's available in generic forms. It's available in a veterinary formulation as well, but again, that would be something that you would be able to get by prescription from your veterinarian. And as you've done, make sure that you've ruled out secondary infections like yeast infections and bacterial infections. Yes, he was treated for a bacterial infection, but many dogs that have allergies also have secondary yeast infections. So have that looked at as well and potentially treated if necessary.
Lynette in Hubertus up next. Hi, Lynette.
Hi, Dr. Sandy. I have a 2.5-year-old Jack Russell mix. Not sure what she's mixed with. Maybe a beagle. But I've noticed that recently her paws oftentimes are really cold. And I just noticed it when I went to clip her nails or something. And it could be if she's standing up, running around, always inside. And it could be when she's all curled up in a ball, sleeping. You know, I'll just grab her paws and they're real cold.
Huh. You know, I always worry about circulation problems, but she's not limping or acting like her feet hurt her at all?
No, not at all.
Not at all.
Not at all.
Yeah, I mean, I just have to assume that dogs are similar to us in that, you know, there are times where, you know, my hands could be warm. There are times where my hands could be very cold, even when I'm inside, and I haven't been outdoors. So if, you know, she doesn't have any skin issues, you've got, you know, she's not sloughing her nails. She doesn't have any limping. You know, I really doubt. I mean, I think you'd be looking for zebras, if, you know, you're starting to say, you know, is there a vascular problem? But if she doesn't have a heart murmur, if she's got good peripheral pulses, and this would be something your veterinarian could tell you, this may just be normal for her. And, you know, if it's not bothering her, it shouldn't bother you. Kind of, kind of just, you know, ignore it if it's not a big deal.
All right.
Okay, great. Thank you so much.
Thanks for calling. And we have Roger in La Crosse next. Hi, Roger.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I have a huge English bulldog named Dino, and he's 3. And about a year ago, we just moved here a couple months ago from the Chicago area, but our old vet, Dino, once in a great while would suddenly get a head shake. It didn't affect his behavior. He didn't freak out. And this little head shake would last maybe about a minute, maybe two, and then he'd be back to normal. And there was no real trigger for it. And I'd say maybe once a month I'd see this happen and we'd get through it. And I asked my vet in Chicago, and without any real long thought process, she said, oh, it's epilepsy.
Yeah.
And I've had friends with epileptic dogs, and it did not seem like an epileptic seizure. And right away, the treatment was like, well, just phenobarbital for life.
Yeah.
But then some friends of mine said, well, we know English bulldog people, and they said there was something called bully head shake, which was not as a big a deal and didn't require treatment. They said it was more like almost like a diabetic sugar reaction.
Huh.
Of some sort, and they said, and there was, and so then I researched it, and there was a bunch of people said that it was an okay thing, and it wasn't going to be detrimental to his health. So I was just trying to figure out what this is.
Yeah, yeah. First of all, I want to comment on your dog's name. Did you say Bino?
Dino.
Oh, I thought you said Bino. And I was like, oh, you know, Bino's used for flatulence. And I went, what a great name. I'm going to have to bank that one and use that for a dog in the future. Because everyone knows, like, English bulldogs are the prince and princess of flatulence. But my guess is that your dog is probably having what we would call a partial seizure, where they just get, you know, a head tremor and it lasts about a minute and it goes away. I had a Yorkie that did the same thing. She would just, her head would tremor. She would start to go in reverse. It would last a minute or two and then she'd be back to normal again. So I'd be talking to your veterinarian about partial seizures, which epilepsy, basically that it's just a form of seizures. And that was the first thing that came to my mind. I mean, if it's not associated with ear infections or, you know, anything wrong with the skin or anything like that that's causing them to shake their head, you know, if it's just this little tremor, that's probably the most likely problem is that. If it was something like blood sugar, that's not going to just last a minute. If you've got a dog that's becoming hypoglycemic, they're going to be weak everywhere. They're going to be, you know, showing mentation changes. It's not going to just come and go in a minute like your dog is displaying. So, you know, whether you have to treat or not, remember, treating seizures, your dog doesn't have to hold a job or drive a car or, you know, anything like that where they could be putting their safety and the safety of others at risk. So I don't think we probably, you know, if it's minor like this, even have to consider treatment. Phenobarb itself is a drug that has a whole wide list of side effects, including liver issues and so on. So I'd be, you know, I personally, if it was my dog, it was lasting once a month, it wasn't affecting the dog's quality of life, it wasn't increasing in severity or frequency, I would just keep a little seizure diary, even though it's a partial seizure. And if they start changing and becoming more frequent or interfering with your dog's quality of life, then by all means, treat. But,
and he's great. Outside of those minimal things that have occurred, he's just a big, lovable English bulldog.
So yeah.
I really don't want to increase the risk with the phenobarbital.
Yeah. So I think, you know, just, you know, but I agree with your vet. It probably is epilepsy, but probably a very minor form. And yeah. I the only thing I disagree with is I would have gone over treatment with you and pros and cons and let you be the one to decide whether you felt your dog needed to be treated or not.
All right.
Fantastic. Thank you so much.
Yep, you're welcome. Thanks a lot for calling.
Well, I am going to use Bino for my next bulldog that I get, you know? Can you imagine Vanna White Trash and Bino? Yes.
That's a great name.
It is. But Dino was his name. So sorry, Dino. Didn't mean to make fun of your name. Yeah.
Oh, man. Ron emailed in, wonders if you could recommend a good over-the-counter medication for ear mites in cats, or would it be best to see the vet for that?
The problem is making sure that it truly is ear mites. I had a cat in the other day, strictly indoors, some brown waxy discharge in its ear. The owner went out, said, oh, I researched it online. Ear mites make brown waxy discharge. So maybe I'll just go ahead and treat. And so this poor cat had been treated with an over-the-counter ear mite medication when it had a yeast infection. I think it's always a good idea if it's a kitty that you can get to the vet, get them in and get them checked. If you are confident that it is ear mites, you've got swabs and a microscope and you can make the diagnosis, then the over-the-counter products that you could use, there's several that are available. You can get them at pretty much any pet store. They're typically topical insecticides that have mild insecticide things in them, like a pyrethrin or something that you need to use every other day for a good 21 days. There are veterinary products as well that are used less frequently, usually single treatment applications, and you know, so that would be something you would get from your veterinarian.
Okay, we have Ray in Genoa City, I believe, next. Ray, do you have a quick question?
Yes, it'll be quick. I've got a 6-year-old golden retriever, and we've got one dog too many. I've got a brother-in-law that is willing to accept the dog. He's been used for hunting for a family dog and everything else. We're going to be transitioning him out of our house to my brother-in-law's house, where he'll be primarily an indoor dog and a family pet. The golden does have a little bit of anxiety, chews a little bit, and likes to be close to people. What suggestions would you give for helping with the transition from one household to another?
Usually it's more of a problem for us than it is for the dogs, but bringing things that, like his dog bed, things that smell like his former home, making sure that he is, you know, getting lots of attention when he's there, but also work on making sure that while he's at your brother's, he's also got times where he's left alone, so he doesn't, enhance any separation anxiety, that he starts learning that someone's going to leave, but they're going to come right back. I would wait and see before you start thinking about medicating and using any anxiety drugs and so on. Most dogs don't need anything like that. They usually make the transition pretty smoothly.
All right. There you go. Thank you very much for calling. Dr. Sandy Sawchuk, our guest today, clinical professor at the University of Wisconsin School of Veterinary Medicine. She'll be with us right up until 12:30 today here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We're talking your pet's health today with Dr. Sandy Sawchuk, clinical professor at the University of Wisconsin School of Veterinary Medicine. Larry Mueller here. Thank you so much for listening in. Lots of callers online. We have some emails as well. So let's go back to the phones here and to Karen in Richland Center, who's been patiently waiting. Hi, Karen.
Hi, good morning.
Good morning.
Good afternoon, Larry.
Afternoon, yes.
Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I am the manager and the caretaker for Richland County Friends of Animals, and we take in a lot of dogs. And in the years that I've been managing this shelter, I got to tell you, I've seen a lot of different behaviors from a lot of different dogs. But one of the most bizarre and one of the most unsettling is I've seen several dogs chatter their teeth as if, you know, when you're a child and you come out of the water after you've been swimming and your teeth just chatter.
Yep.
Well, and these dogs are inside, and it seems to be primarily the elderly dogs, the senior citizens that I've got staying here with me.
Mm-hmm.
But their teeth just chatter.
Yeah.
And it's very unnerving.
Yeah. And typically, I mean, when I see that, especially in older dogs, the big things that I think about are jaw pain, and whether they've got dental disease, and many older dogs do, temporomandibular joint arthritis, which, you know, TMJ we can see in dogs as well. It's not uncommon. It's usually not because they're cold. It's not because, you know,
they're scared.
It could be because they're scared, but usually there's going to be more signs of that, such as their whole body's going to tremor and they're, you know, they may be cowering and so on. But
nothing like that.
Yeah.
It's just their jaws.
Yeah. Looking very careful at their teeth. And I know you are a shelter, and, you know, getting, you know, oral x-rays done and having a good thorough exam done in the mouth is probably not in the budget for, you know, animals that you're keeping there. But, you know, that's probably something that anyone that adopts them, you'd say they need to have a good dental evaluation done. That would be my first guess.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and one more thing, and then I'll let you go. One more question.
Uh-huh.
Sure.
Another behavior that I've seen with just one dog, little girl, she's been with the shelter for about 4 years now, and she has a tendency to go up to every dog, any dog, while they're sleeping or whether they're lying in bed or whatever, and she just licks their eyes and their ears.
Huh.
Is that unusual, or is that typical of... I mean, I've never seen another dog do this.
Well, a lot of dogs will groom other dogs,
and so
it's not uncommon for them to do that. And some of it may be kind of an appeasement-like behavior. When puppies are baby, like little, and they're with their mom, they'll lick around their muzzle, and you know, that's a way of them showing appeasement. So it may be related to that, and it may be that she's too nervous to go up when they're awake, so she waits till they're sleeping. It could be something as simple as, hey, they've got some earwax, and boy, that's yummy, or a little bit of nasal discharge, and, you know, the dog likes to eat boogers. Who knows, you know? But that may be all it is as well, so... I think it's kind of cute. I wouldn't worry about it. Yeah.
She cleans their ears. She cleans their eyes. I mean, it's good in that sense, but I've just never seen the behavior before, and I was wondering if this is something that I should be concerned about.
And it may even be some kind of weird maternal-like behavior because, you know, mother dogs have to lick the belly and genital area of dogs to get puppies to get them to go to the bathroom. You know, maybe she's just got the ends confused. Who knows?
Well, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
All right. Thanks, Karen. And, hey, thanks for what you do there at Richland Center. That's great. Appreciate it very much. Allison and Madison, let's go to you next. Hi, Allison.
Hi. We adopted two kittens about 4.5 years ago, and the orange tabby, Peach, has always been kind of obsessed and a little possessive of her food bowl, and she frequently throws up after eating. We noticed that it would happen whenever the bowl had been empty, so now we're using a dish that you can fill and, you know, gravity pulls it back down after the bowl is empty.
Yeah.
But she definitely is putting on a little bit of weight. I think she's like a Garfield.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
And she's, you know, just really concerned about the bowl. She goes there if, you know, she's worried mm-hmm. about something or anything, so...
Yeah. And some cats, especially indoor cats, I mean, that's their big joy in life is eating. And so finding other things to keep her occupied with toys and so on and, you know, individual attention so that food isn't her only focus in her life. But I call this syndrome piggy cat syndrome where, you know, the bowl's empty and, oh my God, I got to wolf down as much as I can. If not, my housemate's going to eat my food. And then they throw it all up because they've overfilled their stomach. So a few things you might want to look into. One would be using a food dish that instead of like your standard dish, using something like a cookie sheet or a muffin tin where you put little bits of food in each of those containers. So it's kind of like walking around at a buffet. You know, you can eat a little bit slower because you're carrying your plate or, you know, you've got to go and dish stuff up all over the place. So look into doing something like that that may slow her down. I'd also be looking at maybe giving her some privacy during mealtime so that you take out that social issue that may be involved with the other cat in the household where she may be trying to, you know, eat the food before, you know, her competitor comes in and takes the rest of it. So having them separate during meal times would be advisable as well if you can do that. And that's the big problem with free choice feeding is they get fat. I just talked to someone today and I said, you know, having that 24-hour buffet open in a strictly indoor cat, that's like us going on a cruise. You know, you're laying all inside, all, you know, on the cruise ship, you're not exercising, and 24-hour buffet open. No one leaves a cruise without gaining weight. Then that's exactly what you're doing with your cat.
There you go.
We just put like the muffin dish out twice a day or that kind of thing?
Yeah, I mean, trying that would slow her down, and then you can control the amount of food she's getting. And this would be something your veterinarian could help you with looking at her current body weight, what she needs to weigh, perhaps by going back and looking at former medical records with their weight and calculating out her caloric needs per day, and then turning that into the amount of food you need to feed her. And so it may come down to she needs 2/3 of a cup of food a day, and you may say, okay, let's give a third a cup in the morning and the evening, and we'll spread it out in a muffin tin, and, you know, and so she's got a couple of kernels here and there, and you know, it's amazing how just doing something simple like that will give the cat a little mental stimulation, and it really does slow them down and stop some of that binge and purge activity.
Mm. There you go. Good luck. Thanks, Allison.
Okay, bye-bye.
Jay in Appleton, on to you. Hi, Jay.
Hi. I just adopted my dog. It's my first dog ever, 2 weeks ago from the local Humane Society. And last week, about a week after I brought her home, she gnawed about a quarter size chunk of her pad off her back left foot. And yesterday, she gnawed about a nickel-sized chunk of pad off of one of her front foot. I took her to the vet, and they said, you know, there's nothing, no, she didn't bleed, make it bleed, and it's not too deep, and it's just probably she's irritated from the salt or something in the road. But mm-hmm. it's got me nervous, and I'm a first-time pet owner. I thought I'd give you a call.
So this happened when she was left alone, or?
The first time she chewed her back foot, I was doing the dishes, and I noticed her gnawing on her foot, and I went over there and tried to get her to stop, and she wouldn't stop until I gave her a treat.
Huh.
And then the second time with her front foot yesterday, she was out of my sight, and I didn't see when she did it.
Okay, okay. Yeah, definitely looking for things like between the toes that can cause irritation. Does she have a yeast or bacterial infection between the toes? I mean, if there's any sign of redness or irritation there, then definitely that needs to be addressed.
I took her to the vet yesterday, and there was no sign of
it. Nothing. And then you start thinking, is this a like a self-mutilation type behavior because she's anxious, and, you know, I'm in a new environment, and it would be, you know, similar to someone biting their fingernails to the quick, or, you know, but twisting their hair or doing something bizarre that way. Boy, that's a bizarre way to, you know, present though. Mm-hmm. Typically they'll lick a spot on their leg or whatever, but not actually cause that much damage. I'm still not convinced that there isn't something wrong with her feet though. The fact that she did it in front of you and then at another time and you couldn't stop the behavior by just, you know, calling her name or whatever. You had to distract her with food and hopefully that didn't reward it. Probably not. But if she'll tolerate wearing socks or booties, that may help. There are, you know, if it's just that her pads are irritated, you know, there's some stuff called musher's wax, which is, you know, goes on feet to help with the, you know, repelling salt and things. You can get it at pet stores or online. I'm not sure what to tell you without actually having a look to see is there a medical problem actually going on.
Yeah, there you go. Good luck. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate it. Dave in Bruce, Wisconsin, has a cat who's 6 years old. Be perfect, except for one thing. She she poops outside of her box. She pees in her box, poops outside of her box 90% of the time. He's tried every kind of litter.
Yeah. My guess is that he probably doesn't have enough litter boxes.
He's probably got one.
Yeah.
He needs two.
He needs two. The rule of thumb for litter boxes in cats is a litter box for every cat in the household plus one. Ideally not covered. Many cats like to urinate in one place and defecate in another. So not putting them side by side, making sure that they're in separate parts of the house, that may be helpful. You may find that, you know, she may do okay with two litter boxes in the same area. Making sure that they're clean, making sure that she doesn't have any medical issues that could be causing her to defecate out of the box. Something simple like impacted anal glands can be associated with pain. And so she may say, I go in this box. It hurts, so instead of going here, I'm going to go outside. So don't rule, you know, say that it's just a management problem. Make sure that you get her checked out medically. And if everything comes back clean, then start addressing it from the management standpoint and give her an extra litter box.
Our cats use two. We had three, and they never used the one. But they pee in one, and they poop in the other.
Yeah, I have three cats, and there's definitely one litter box that, or I have two cats, three litter boxes. One box that's preferred, one that's used randomly, and then another one that's used maybe 20% of the time. So there's definitely a preference in whether that's location. They've all got the same litter in them. I don't know, but it may just be that one that they really like, because I only scoop once a day, gets a little dirty, and so now they have to go use the other ones. But I've never had a problem, so knock on wood.
Dude, Claire in Eau Claire wonders, do dogs get lonely when another dog dies? Should we be concerned about our remaining dog and get another dog sooner than later?
Oh, that's a really good question. And we do know that dogs can appear to grieve. And if you've got two dogs that are very bonded, especially if the dog that passed away was the kind of controlling leader dog that's like, okay, we're going to go out now. Okay, we're going to bark at the window now. The dog that remains may be a little lost without having somebody there to be able to kind of tell them what to do. So whether you get get another dog or not really depends on, you know, your current dog that you have. If they are really dog friendly and they love another dog, and you find that maybe you can, you know, go over to a friend's house, and if you're that has a dog, and if your dog perks up and is back to normal and eating well and playing and so on, then obviously that would be a good indication that getting another dog would be helpful. But, you know, your dog may not want another dog. They may want the dog that passed away, just like you do. So it's really an individual thing. But what I would recommend is waiting a little bit until you're ready to accept another dog. I mean, because you're definitely going to be the one to take care of it, not the existing dog.
Danny in Green Bay, let's turn to you now. Hi, Danny.
Hi. I've got a 9-month-old Chihuahua. She's perfect pretty much in every sense of the word, except when we let her outside, she doesn't come back in when we call her. I'll go blue in the face before she'll even make a direction towards the house.
Okay.
The minute she hears the treats, which is what we usually use when we're trying to get ready in the morning, you know, she comes just book it.
All right. And so you've got a dog that is definitely not deaf. If she can hear the treats, hey, you know, exactly. She's just choosing to ignore you. So this is where you need to work on something which is called the recall. And my little phrase that I like people to remember is, if you can't control the dog, control the environment. So in this case, I'd say don't let her go outside to set you up for failure, where you have her on a leash, you go out with her so you can bring her in when you need to, rather than calling and losing all the time. When you're in a position, like perhaps in the house or, you know, someplace where she may be outdoors, but in a very small space where you can have her come back easily, I would be working on having her learn a recall where she comes. And I tell owners to go through this like very systematically, where you teach her to come to you, she gets a treat, and she can go back and play, so that you repeat over and over again. So it's no longer, when I get called, I am going to have my fun activity end, or I'm going to get punished because now Dad's mad because he's been yelling for the last 5 minutes. So you just, you know, work on maybe just a few feet from you in the house, having her come, sit, get a treat, but also add in touch her collar, because dogs become very in tune to the, you know, what you're doing. And so if all of a sudden you're just calling her, here's a treat, go play, have a treat, go play, and then all of a sudden play's over and you really have to bring her in, and you suddenly just shift a little bit to reach for her collar or to pick her up, then she's going to run off and be gone again, because she knows this is the end of something really fun. So have her come to you, sit, touch her collar, give her a treat, go play. And then gradually you can start incorporating that outside. And every once in a while, fun's going to end. But boy, you've made coming to you a really fun activity.
All right.
All right. Thank you.
Good luck.
Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. Carolyn just posted a cute pet picture and a thank you to Sandy on our Facebook page. So,
nice. I'll have to go and check that out.
Yeah. So, and I tell you what, if you would like to listening in and you would like to add a picture to the Facebook page, we would love to have it. So go to the Larry Mueller Facebook page and post your picture. Arlene in New Berlin, on to you now. Hi, Arlene.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
You took my daughter's call earlier from Sheboygan. The reason I'm calling is, you know, the discharge on dogs' eyes, is there anything you can kind of let me know what you can do to alleviate some of that? I have a dog named Hershey. He's a chocolate miniature poodle.
Mm-hmm.
That's the name Hershey. And but he gets a real, it's not a lot. I don't know if it has to do with the cold weather, but he gets a real kind of yellowish, discharge, and I wipe his eyes out with I'm just wondering if there's anything else that I can do.
Well, some discharge from eyes is normal. Just like us, we wake up in the morning, we may have a little sleeper in the corner of our eye, and that's pretty normal, but poodles, because they have so much hair in the corner of their eyes, sometimes this excessive normal discharge will start to build up. But, you know, it sounds like, though, the fact that you're finding yellow discharge, that's an indication that there's an infection going on.
It's kind of like yellow. He goes to the vet every year. The vet says he's doing fine. He isn't running in the bushes or anything like that where he would might injure his eye.
Yeah.
And because I'm very, you know, I don't want to lose this little
thing. Yeah, but if the next time you're in at your veterinary clinic that you go to, ask them to specifically look at the eyes. And they may want to do what I call a conjunctival scrape or cytology. It's a very simple thing where they just take some of the cells off the lining of the lower eyelid and have a look on the slide to see if there's pus cells there, if there's inflammatory cells. Sometimes we'll put some numbing drops in the eye and actually look on the underside of the third eyelid to see if there's a bunch of what are called follicles, which is an indication that your dog has an infection and is responding to something or an allergic reaction. So I think a more thorough eye exam is in order. Also be looking at whether your dog has hair rubbing on its eyes, because poodles are hairy. If they have any, you know, hair touching the surface of their eye, that can add to the irritation and contribute to the discharge and infection as well. So the next time you're at the groomer, make sure that they're keeping that hair well trimmed away from around the face so that there's no hair rubbing on the eye. While you're at the vet, ask them to look for things like extra eyelashes that can cause irritation, and just evaluate the conformation of your dog's face. Some poodles have very deep set eyes, and we'll see we actually call it poodle epiphora, which just means poodle tears, where it's so common in the breed to get that extra tearing, and it's because of combination of conformation, the way their eye and their face is shaped, as well as having all that hair on their face. But my guess is that your dog has an eye infection that really needs to be addressed.
There you go. Thank you very much for calling. Sue from Winneconne says she has a 13-year-old beagle named Angel, who's healthy. As she's gotten older, I noticed that when she's standing or sitting that her front leg shakes. It also happens when she's laying. Sometimes her back leg shakes. I also noticed that when she closes her mouth, her bottom jaw chatters when she's trying to close it. She doesn't appear to be in any type of pain. Is it possible for a dog to get Parkinson's?
No, I mean, it's not that I've ever seen, but we do see some kind of Parkinsonian type syndromes in dogs that can be medication related and so on. But my guess is that her dog probably is uncomfortable. It probably is stressing her joints. She's an elderly poodle or beagle, and that she probably is a little uncomfortable. Most dogs aren't going to yowl in pain or want to get sympathy, but whenever we see that kind of jaw chatter, the limb shaking, that's the first thing that I think about. And I'd talk to your veterinarian about seeing a trial of some pain medication, have a good oral exam done, check those joints out, and see if there's something that they can do to make your dog feel more comfortable. Perhaps just a non-steroidal anti-inflammatory like Rimadyl that we mentioned earlier in the show.
All right. Nancy in Grafton, hello.
Oh, this is a good story. Fella I take care of, I'm a caregiver, and the man is 95 years old. And his wife had been in a nursing home for about, long, long time. And this couple never had children. Well, the wife died, and then one day the man said, you know, years ago we used to have a cat. And I says, well, Ezra, would you like a cat? And he says, yeah, I think so. So I was at a different facility, and I mentioned I was looking for a cat. This one gal working there, she says, you want a cat? You want a cat? We got two. We got to get rid of one of them. You can have her free. Well, I went right down the street, and I picked up this cat, and I brought it up to the man's house. Well, it turned out that the man and his wife, of course, never had children. Well, this little black cat's name was Baby. And here he was, a widower, never had children, and now at 95 he has a baby.
Oh!
So he had the baby for a couple of weeks, and it turned out that the baby bit him on the back of the hand, and it swelled up like a boxing glove, and he had all his shots. And so he got a couple rounds of amoxicillin, and I said, you know what? As I can find another place for the cat. Oh, no, he says, yeah. She's getting better. And, you know, he says, she sleeps with me on the other side of the bed. There's nobody there anyway.
Yeah. Oh. And, you know, thank you for bringing this story up. I think the moral of the story, though, is any cat bite wound needs to be medically addressed as soon as possible. Many people have lost, function in their hands and have nerve damage and so on from infection. So I'm glad he got the care he needed and that he has a good buddy now.
I am too. Thank you so much for
calling. Nice way to end the show.
That's a great way to end the show. And Sandy, thank you so much. You'll be back Let's see, you will be back on April 11th,
yeah,
I believe.
Yeah, it's a second Tuesday, yes.
The second Tuesday of every month. That's the thing to mark on your calendar. Dr. Sandy Sawchuk will be with us the second Tuesday of every month. And the second Tuesday of April is April 11th. So there you have it. She'll be back with us. Thank you very much. We'll look forward to your next visit. Just to take a look ahead, tomorrow at 11, we'll talk with Darren Bush of Rutabaga Paddle Sports. He'll give us a review of this week's Canucopia event. And then at 11:45, Jerry Apps talks about his new book that involves canoeing and his 25 years of canoeing the boundary waters. Thank you for listening. Stay with us. Lots in store on the Ideas Network.